Speaking of shocking topics, I guess I think it's safe to say that climate change isn't just a future threat, it's already here. From scorching heat waves and bushfires to floods and food insecurity, the impacts are becoming impossible to ignore. And according to new research, the world is currently on track for 2.7 degrees Celsius of global warming by the end of the century. That kind of rise in temperature could mean some widespread disruption to ecosystems, economies, and everyday life. But alongside this warning, another report offers a window of hope. The world's richest and most powerful nations of the G20 have the capacity to produce enough renewable energy to power the whole planet. So, what's holding them back? And how do we move from empty promises of action to actual practical action? To help break all this down, we're now joined by Dr. Sven Teske, a professor and research director at the Institute for Sustainable Futures at UTS. Sven, thanks for joining us this morning.
Thank you for having me.
Wonderful. Thanks you to be here. So, sad to say that we're on track for 2.7 degrees Celsius of warming this century. So, what does that mean in practical terms for ecosystems, economies, and I guess us?
Well, first, I have to say that 2.7 is an estimation. So it could be a bit more, it could be a bit less. It really depends on feedback loops in terms of the impacts we have right now. It's, for example, glaciers are melting, ice caps are melting. That reduces the white area, which reflects sunlight. If the white areas on the caps, North and South Pole, getting smaller, we actually have less reflection, which basically then includes more, even more heating. So we do have feedback loops. But if we basically won't be able to change that and go back to our target, which was agreed in 2015 at the Paris Climate Convention to stay as much as possible under 2 degrees, then we will have more floods, more bushfires, and severe heat waves in the future.
So with all of that being said and with all that's happening now, what climate policies have actually been effective globally and what's made them effective?
Well, there's not one policy. Usually we have already a target. We have a target in terms of the temperature. Paris Climate Agreement already said that between 1.5 and 2 degrees max. So we aim for 1.5 degrees. Last year, we already crossed 1.5 degrees. And that's warmer than at the beginning of the industrialization around 1850. It doesn't mean that we already crossed the target as it is a long-term target over the next 50 years. And we just had 1 year we crossed it. However, we need to reduce CO2 emissions. We also need to stop deforestation and start reforestation. And then we need to break it down to specific measures. So the most important measures is that countries actually have a climate target, then under that an emissions target, and under that a number of targets for different technologies, but also for energy efficiency and biodiversity, for deforestation, reforestation. So that's a huge package of different policies we need to have in order to actually fulfill the target. So there's not only one policy.
And in terms of what are the projected global impacts, say, if the G20 countries do get things together and actually harness their renewable energy potential to counteract the effects that you've just mentioned?
We did an analysis about the potential solar and wind potential. So solar, utility-scale solar, so large-scale solar, not rooftop, that comes on top of the potential I'm about to say, and then only onshore wind. So we did not actually include offshore wind, so wind at sea, which has another huge potential. So if we utilize only the potential we have and we excluded national parks, nature conservation areas, so we excluded quite a lot of land use also for agriculture. So the remaining area would be suitable to supply about 42 times over only with solar, plus 21 times only with onshore wind. So based on the electricity demand we have today. If we have projections how much electricity we need until 2050, and that includes developing countries have more access to electricity and we electrify, so we replace fuels for cars, for example, with electric vehicles, then we still could supply about 10 times over this electricity. So there is no shortage on solar or wind potential, and not to mention we also have other renewables like geothermal, to some extent hydro. So there are so many different technologies we can use, but the main ones will be solar and wind.
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, yeah, if we can flip the script on fossil fuels, especially with cars and everything, and go renewable there, then, you know, hopefully the future will be brighter for us all.
And there are also some good news. The price for solar went down significantly. So over the past 10, 15 years, the cost decreased by over 90%. So I studied in the 90s, and in the 90s, solar was about $2 per kilowatt hour. Now we calculate about 3 cents per kilowatt hour. So that's a lot cheaper. Mm-hmm. Also, in the early 90s, the global installed capacity, sort of the new market for solar photovoltaics alone, was 60 megawatts. This is the amount the world currently builds in about 10 minutes. So mm-hmm. We are on a good trajectory, so it's not all lost. We just need to intensify our renewable energy expansion. We need to intensify our energy efficiency measures. And what we definitely need to do, we should not invest in new fossil fuel projects, but instead use the money into a modern renewable energy-based energy system, which is, at the end of the day, not only more resilient, but also cheaper.
Actually, it's good to know that there's a bit of light and solar light at the end of the tunnel, so to speak. Dr. Sven, unfortunately, we're out of time today, but thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you.
Yeah. And, of course, that was Dr. Sven Teske, a professor and research director at the Institute for Sustainable Futures at UTS, helping to untangle the climate crossroads that we're currently standing at.